This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
We call it the place to be.
Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall.
Place to Be Nation. Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
It is contagious. It is the place to be, and we are live each and every Monday.
To do worse than Josh Richter.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this Monday evening, back in the saddle, alongside my PIC, Scott Criscola. Scott, how are you?
Good evening, JR. Always good to be back. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 470 of the longest running, continuous, never ending, episodic gold standard.
We sometimes go back in time and move around, but it's still the Place to Be podcast, the longest running episodic show.
It'll be Place to Be podcast till the guys who actually do the fucking show say it's not.
Right, correct.
Yeah. We are, and I haven't said it in a while, even though it may not happen till 2020, but we are only 30 away.
Jesus.
Five bills.
Yeah, it's always a way. I guess maybe eventually we'll start planning for it. But we have a special show tonight, Scott. We are taking a slight pivot from our timeline here, but we're staying within the timeline. We're just kind of doing a little something different, and we have a cavalcade of network stars with us here tonight. Why don't we start with, as we always do, I think, seniority within the Place to Be Nation. And that, of course, means the man who recently, I believe, won an Emmy for his turn as Ron Renzi Sr. And that is, of course, Mr. John D'Amato. Been here since day one. That day one-ish, John D'Amato. How are you?
Awesome. Bigger, better, and better. And we're going to party like it's 1987. And I guess it'll be up to you guys to decide which one's bigger, which one's better, and which one's better for the pre-esteemed.
You're all this beautiful. How about that? So, all right. And up next, I believe, I don't know. The timeline's kind of fuzzy as far as, how it goes with, seniority with these next two. So we'll just kind of throw them both out at the same time. Maybe they're, formerly, co-partners on the Titans of Wrestling podcast. They are currently co-hosts of the Worldcast, looking at world-class championship wrestling. One you hear almost every week with us. The other you hear when that guy's out. Our two friends here tonight, Kelly Nelson, Pete Schermacher. How are you guys doing this evening?
Fabulous.
Better than fabulous.
There you go. He upped you.
Hey, you're my understudy at this on this podcast, man. So.
I know. That's why I tried to trump you on the intro there.
Are you guys dressed as the fabulous ones, being a fabulous?
Yeah.
They're both dressed like Armand Hussein. Who's got the worst bro?
I can see Pete rocking that top hat.
I'm squirting the baby oil right now, man, with my Speedo.
Yes, the top hat is all you, Pete.
Somewhere else on top of my head.
Pete still has my head imprint on his shoulder from WrestleMania. Where I was nuzzled in nicely for 7.5 hours during WrestleMania.
Great.
All right, guys. So we wanted to do something a little bit different, like I mentioned earlier tonight. We've been documenting all of 87 here leading up to WrestleMania 3 as of late. And next week we'll be checking out the actual show, WrestleMania 3. But because there's so much to talk about, there's so much build going on for that pay-per-view, we wanted to take a moment tonight to really pay attention and honor the two top feuds going to that show. And what we're going to do is to kind of talk about our general thoughts about those matches, but also take a few minutes to talk about some footage we watched that both play into those matches and kind of go historical into the feuds. Kelly put those together, so we'll talk about those. But first, what I thought we'd do is, for the first half of the show, we're going to talk about Randy Savage versus Ricky Steamboat. And before we get to the footage we watched, I did want to just kind of talk about maybe just both guys, where they were at this point in their careers, your thoughts on the feud itself heading into 3, just kind of, you know, the hype level you're at going into that match, what you were expecting if you were watching at the time. I know we're all in kind of different spots during that era. I think all of you were probably watching. You know, I wasn't, obviously, but I think you guys all were. So let's talk about that. Johnny, start us off. Just your thoughts kind of on Savage and Steamboat at this point. And then, you know, let's make this conversation. We can just kind of go from there with just your thoughts on their respective positions on the ladder and what the careers we're looking at this point in the company.
Well, Steamboat definitely was just coming off two of the greatest feuds with Morocco and then Jake, and after those two feuds did, which pretty much dominated the late 85 and 86, he was ready for some gold, and I mean obviously he's not going to go after the world title because that's a taken by the Hulk, but he was definitely IC title ready here. And to line him up with Savage, it was just a natural fit. And I mean, they're both great workers. And as far as Steamboat is the ultimate babyface, and Savage was coming in, and he was the ultimate heel. So it was just a natural transgression that Steamboat would get the IC title shots.
Kelly, did you feel that he was like in line? Like, was it a natural progression for Steamboat? Did you feel like it was too soon, too late, or did you feel like this was like? He had escalated perfectly to crest at the exact time that they needed him to be in this position.
Yeah, well, when he came in 85, he had a shot with Valentine when Valentine was the IC champ at the Garden. And I think a lot of people expected that to be the title change because that seemed like the Tito-Valentine feud had petered out at that point. This was June 85. And if you watch that match, the crowd definitely is sensing like this could be the title change. Because they would often do that, right? They would give the title to someone who had just been around for a few months as like, well, he's a hot new star, and give him the strap. So that was June 85. And then, yeah, he got into the blood feuds that kind of sidetracked him. He was like Tommy Rich in a way. Tommy Rich would be an NWA title contender, but then he would get sidetracked into like blood feuds, of course, with Bud Sawyer, the most famous one. So Steamboat, yeah, it was time. I mean, Macho had a hot feud also with Tito. And, yeah, it was the perfect timing. Both guys had been built up strong, and both were great in the ring. And it was, it was the right time for sure.
Savage. Scott, we've talked a lot about Savage's reign.
Yeah!
We've talked a lot about his reign on this show. Like, what did you think of his reign to date? Was he kind of in need of a feud like this after coming off all the stuff with Steel? Or, you know, the further we dove into those house shows, we saw that the Tito thing actually ran longer than we thought it had and some other pieces behind it. But did you feel like to really legitimize and put his reign over the top, he needed something like this with a guy like Steamboat?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt. One of the things that I've learned a lot about since we've been doing the refresh was how long the Tito feud went. I pretty much thought he beat him in February, had a couple of shots by like May was done, and then we had 50,000 terrible George Steele matches. But really, the Tito feud went, Jesus, into the fall almost. And whether it was tags or things like that, I mean, Tito got, if you count MSG, the Spectrum, Boston, I mean, he probably had combined between losing in February and probably like September, he probably had like 16 title shots. Yeah. Just in those three buildings alone. And all the matches were great. The chemistry was good between them. The problem was, I feel like for Savage, his problem was visibility. Mm. It wasn't his in-ring work, obviously. Although, and I had said for years that he really didn't flip the switch till this point with Savage, with Steamboat, but I disagree. I definitely take that back. I didn't realize he had kind of gotten things down a bit. What I think hurt Savage in 86, at least till the end of the year, was the Saturday Night's main events. Because he could have been on more of them, or he could have had better opponents. The problem was, you know, Vince is a sicko, loved George Steele, must have been one of his dad's leftovers. We could have seen many more variety, much more variety of opponent for Savage throughout the year nationally than we did. Instead, I don't think him and Tito wrestled nationally.
No,
as far as I know, if we remember correctly, it was all Steel until the one match he had with Jake.
Yeah.
Which was very, very good. And that was more of a test thing for Jake to see if they really wanted him to turn babyface. Or if, as a matter of fact, Savage was gaining some face pops. But the linchpin for Savage being able to stay a heel was always Elizabeth. When he, you know, shoved her around like a piece of shit, you always were going to get booed. So that was more of a test match. As good as the match was, the premise behind that match was more Jake than Savage. The problem with Savage was visibility, because we saw him on MSG, and you know, Philly fans saw him at the Spectrum House shows and stuff. But on a national scale, you saw him squash guys on the Cindies, and then you saw like a zillion terrible George Animal Steel matches. So there was no doubt that by the fall, he needed Ricky Steamboat badly.
Pete, what do you think of that? What do you think of that point? Do you agree that he needed that to help put his, like, what were your thoughts on the Steel feud that ate up most of 86 on a national perspective for a guy like Savage?
Well, it was for in-ring, it was terrible, but it was actually entertaining for a television product. Where you get behind it, the Beauty and the Beast with Steel and Elizabeth, and but it really cranked up the heeldom of Savage. So, I mean, I felt, to really put the heat on Savage, I really felt the Steel feud really helped him in that essence, where it actually helped flesh out his character more than the in-ring work, of course. So, I mean, you got to look at it in different aspects, not just always the in-ring linchpin, but also what he's doing for him as a character. And I felt the Steel feud actually helped Savage as a help him with the character work, which would actually help him even further when he became world champion. But it was definitely needed after coming off a feud where it was so character-based. He definitely needed a feud he could really sink his teeth into, and that's definitely Ricky Steamboat. And that feud really clicked. And you also got to think about Savage coming into the territory, what a kind of like clean slate he was, because like most of these guys have been seasoned in the territories and have history with other guys, but Savage really, I mean, he was on doing Outlaws for his father, and maybe, you know, had a little, you know, a little cup of coffee in the Memphis territory against Lawler and Dundee and that ilk, and he did a little work in St. Louis. But for the most part, yeah, he didn't really have a whole lot of history of guys he's worked with going into that company. So most of these feuds, they're all like brand new to him, where he didn't have already working with other people in other territories and stuff.
I think the problem that eventually Vince would work out with Saturday's Main Event, in a general sense – and he's not wrong, because it was all about marketing. Pretty much every Saturday's Main Event was focused on Hogan. And that's not wrong. Hogan's the money man. But you do sacrifice the rest of your roster in terms of being taken seriously on a national scale. And it would be like Hogan would take up maybe 55 to 60% of the show, and then maybe 20% in some sort of mid-card thing, mostly involving Savage. Although Savage at times could have been needed. And then the rest was crap. And I think that's where a lot of the and JR, I know you like you liked our themed Saturday's Main Events. Notice we've kind of strayed away from that throughout the back end of 86 and into early 87. And that helps a little bit, because the gimmick stuff, like that Halloween episode, is as hilarious as it is, really does nothing from a roster perspective. But it was entertaining, it was fun, it was Halloween, and that was the point. But you notice by the time we got to the Saturday's Main Event in June or in March, when Bundy attacked him and we were set up with WrestleMania 2, and Saturday's Main Event became more of a show that needed to have some storyline advancement. You can't just be the one marketing show that you put on nationally and, hey, look, here's Hogan. Yay. Okay. Show's over. They needed to actually treat this kind of as a more serious, wrestling storyline show. And by the end of 86, you do see that. Mm-hmm. But I think Savage was one of the ones kind of sacrificed because of that. The other problem was, and I'm going to dominate the answer, but I'm curious your guys' thoughts on this as well. We talked about when we do the shows, the house show episodes, JR, and we go into you know, where the rest of the roster was on that specific evening. Savage was not around a lot at the Garden. He'd be in, you know, Podunk, wherever. And you sometimes wonder, do you maybe put him at the Garden and let the tag team guys handle that? Not all the time, but Savage definitely needed to be on, because obviously back in the tape trading days, as you and I know, John, the Garden was the shows everybody wanted to see. So I think sometimes there was an issue there in terms of roster where maybe Savage needed to be in some of the more high-profile places and he wasn't. But that's just my opinion.
Well, he was at the Garden way more than Hogan was in 85 and 86.
Yeah, true. Yeah, no, there was a lot of exposure at that point for him. And I mean, that's where some of those hottest matches that we saw came from during that time period as well, with the tag and the stuff with Bruno and all that.
The difference, though, let me say this real quick, Kelly. The difference with Hogan is Hogan didn't need the Garden. Or the Garden didn't need Hogan all the time.
Yeah, I don't know.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no, but Hogan would have sold out the Omaha Civic Center or whatever the fuck it is.
Your point is that the Garden, I just want to make sure you're articulating your point. So your point is that the Garden, you don't need Hogan to sell the Garden because it's the Garden, but if Hogan's not in Omaha per se, you may not sell out because he's not there. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And if you're not going to have Hogan at the Garden, you at least got to get Savage. And there were a couple of house shows we had where neither of them were there. Mm. And that wasn't good.
What do you think?
Well, Savage,
go ahead, Kel.
So.
Yeah, Savage was the B show headliner most of the time, against Steel, against Santana as well. And they drew well. Like, Savage was a big draw right from the get-go in the WWF.
Joe, what do you think of that point about, do you think the Garden needed Hogan, or do you think it's, like, basically, do you agree with Scott's point on that?
No, definitely, because even as you guys saw, some of those cards without Hogan were a few thousand short of a sellout. And when Hogan was there, it was a definite, it was a short thing sellout. So it was definitely, I mean, Hulk definitely brought things over the top.
Like, very rarely, John, at least the shows I remember that you probably went to, very rarely did we have a house show where they had to overflow to the Felt Forum without him. Mm. Very rarely. A non-Hogan show had to spill over to the other, you know, downstairs and get, you know, and get the 22,000, 23,000. So, that, you know, that's all I'm saying is that Hogan was needed to fill these little podunk places, and Savage could have used the guard more to help himself. And I think the crowds, hey, man, I had 22,000. We still would have had 16, 17, 18, and still would have had a good crowd without Hogan. But there were some stinkers we had where we had neither of them. And it was dreadful. Like, I think sometimes Vince, and I know we're going off a different topic, but I think there are times Vince took advantage of the Garden or took it for granted that MSG's MSG. And as we've, as we've seen JR and Kelly, that wasn't always the case. we've had a good 2.5 hours of paint drying at times without those guys. But anyway, the whole premise, my point is, I think Savage's visibility hurt him the first like 8 months of 86, even with the George Steel matches. And I think Steamboat kind of opens that up for him because Steamboat so popular on a national scale because of his popularity in the South and, you know, being in the NWA and the Flair feuds and that kind of thing. So I think it definitely helped him to hook up with Steamboat as quickly as possible in the fall of 86.
Pete, talk about Steamboat's career, like, until this point, and then we'll open up discussion on this topic, because I'm curious, like, where he was as a wrestler, is basically from his debut till 1987, is he at his best here, or is he better at other times and this isn't exactly his peak? I know later on, obviously he gets better, but talk to me up to 87 in his career. Like, where do you think this stretch lies?
I honestly think his hottest, I think 83, 84 is really peaked. And I thought 85, 86, 87, he was still having tremendous years, but I felt 83 and 84, he was having just incredible matches. I mean, even when you think about it, in 1977, if you look at some of that stuff, him and Flair were doing was straight out cutting edge stuff where they were way ahead of the pack. It's kind of like how Meltzer talks about Kenny Omega and those guys, about the pace they're setting, except Flair and Steamboat had a great, incredible psychology to what they were doing, and so he was immediately, he was clicking right off with Flair in 77. But I mean, I think it's very hard to say where he really peaked, because I mean, he was great from 77 till he retired. He didn't ever really down, and then when he came back in 2000, what was this? Well, what year was he come back?
Nine.
Yeah. I mean, he had a great match. He had a really strong match with Jericho. I heard he was having great matches with Drew McIntyre. on house shows. Having, I think Dylan Hale said he had a match of the year contender on the house show he went to, and that's with him having like freaking 15 years of layoff and stuff. which is just absolutely nuts when you think about it.
In fairness, every match Dylan sees live is usually a match of the year contender, but his point probably stands on this one.
So, I mean, the guy's psychology has always been good. I'll say it. I think Ricky Steamboat has the best wrestling psychology I've ever seen when it comes to working an arm or working a leg. If you see him, people always like talk about his arm drag, for example. You want to know what? You don't see him usually pop off the arm drag if he's working a headlock. If he's working an arm, then he's popping off an arm drag. So he doesn't even just do moves to pop you. He does it if it makes sense in the ring. And sometimes you'll see him, oh, why is he going after the leg? Oh, it's to get back to the arm that he's working on. The guy, his psychology is incredible. It's his psychology's always been there since starting it, watching those Cornette tapes in 77 with Flair. And Wahoo and Paul Jones and Jay Youngblood. I mean, you go from 77, then you see him more in 1983 at the final conflict against Slaughter and Canoodle. And then you see him in 84. We see him before the big 89 series with Flair, but he had the one on the Steamboat DVD where they go an hour, which is an awesome hour draw. And then you have him in the Meadowlands, who were people who did not know Ricky Steamboat and Ric Flair, and they tear the house down with a hot crowd behind them again in 84. So I think he peaked. I think he peaked in 84, going right into the WWF, and in 87, I think having him in Savage is kind of lightning in the bottle, where you have probably your two best athletes in that company at that point. And arguably, you could probably maybe make the argument they were the number one and number two in-ring performers in the company at that point. And what they end up doing is gold. And the greatest thing for us that happened was you could never really see what the feud was until the 24/7 came out.
Mm-hmm.
And then it really, really fleshed out their feud on not just going from the throat injury all the way to Mania. We got to see a bunch of the house shows and actually saw the feud transpire even more, and we got to understand it a lot better.
Kelly, what do you think was Steamboat's best match pre-WrestleMania 3? It doesn't have to be star rating. What is what you personally feel is his best match that you've seen until that point?
Well, Final Conflict is awesome. The tag in the cage that Pete mentioned. As a singles, against Tully at Starrcade 84 is a real strong match. The Broadway with Flair in 84 is really good.
A match that people don't talk about is Dick Slater on a Worldwide episode. He comes completely out of his character, where it's more of a brawl. But again, it's Ricky Steamboat, so there's an incredible psychology of not only is he brawling with Dick Slater, but he's working the back during this brawl, and it's absolutely fan-freaking-tastic. If people haven't seen it, you need to check it out.
Yeah, and from the garbage tapes, from the Cornette garbage tapes, something everybody should see is Flair against Steamboat with Andre the Giant as referee. And it's clipped, but you get at least 10 minutes, and it's really strong, and the crowd is just freaking nuclear for them. It's a really cool snapshot. That's from like 1978.
Yeah, there's another one they just recently put together from the garbage tapes.
Yeah.
Where you get 22 minutes of it.
Wow.
And it's just worked just like, because it's right off the angle of Steamboat getting his face blistered up by Flair in the studio.
Right.
The big black eye. And it's almost a lot. It's very similar to the Ricky Morton Great American Bash cage match, where you see Flair just trying to. It's kind of like a blood feud, obviously, where you see Flair going after the eye, and Steamboat, his revenge spots are about busting up Flair's eyes and nose. It's fantastic stuff.
Yeah, there's some good stuff, but it's those territories, for the most part, didn't have footage from their biggest shows in full, so Final Conflict, we're lucky that was preserved, that was taped, so we have that whole match. But there's so much great Ricky Steamboat that, you know, happened but just wasn't taped. You know, it's unfortunate, of course.
Scott, what do you think's been Savage's best match in the WWF pre these matches of Steamboat? We've watched a bunch now. And
well,
John, want you to weigh in on this too.
That six man that we had on the last house show.
All right, well, give me his best singles performance.
Singles?
Yeah.
Well, the one with Jake on Saturday's main event is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
The one with Hogan, which one was it?
January 86.
January 86. Yeah. That one's pretty awesome. Yeah. There's a couple, Kel, that you that we have on the playlist. You said before Steamboat. Yeah, I would say those two. That Hogan one from that January 86 house show and that six-man tag. Oh, I forgot you said singles. Yeah, that and the Jake match are really good. And I mean, it's hard to break down any of the Tito's because all of the post-title change Tito's were all very, very good. I mean, there's one specific.
My favorite of those, Scott, is the one from Toronto.
Yeah.
Yep, that's a good one. The ones we're thinking of, Peter, the specific MSG ones, the one in Toronto is very good. I actually watched that one off YouTube.
Okay, but the MSG one from it, I would go with the No DQ one, and I'd probably say my favorite.
Which one was that one, JR? Is that July?
I thought it was March. April, maybe.
I think April, yeah.
Yeah, that was April 22nd.
Okay. Yeah, and the Toronto match is a no DQ. It's basically the same match, but with a little more violence to it.
Mm. That's the one I'm thinking of. It's pretty good.
They have that ramp in Toronto.
Yeah,
I would probably say the April 86 with Tito, the January 86 with Hogan, and the Saturday's main event with Jake. Those three you could interchange. And then just in general, not a singles match, but that six-man tag we saw in February of 87 with him, Harley, and Adonis against, what was it, Piper, Hogan, and not Piper and Hogan, Piper, Steamboat, and JYD. Yeah, I mean, that six-man is incredible, but that's obviously not a solo. But I would say the January 86 with Hogan, the April 86 with Tito, and the Saturday's main event with Jake. All three of those are exceptional. And again, it brings me back to my misconception as a kid that I thought that Savage didn't hit his in-ring stride until after WrestleMania 3, but I was dead wrong watching all these house show matches. So.
John, you agree with us?
Yeah, I like especially the ones with Tito, definitely. Even though after he won the belt, though, the finishers were a little screwy because they had to keep the belt on him and kind of screwed Tito a little, but otherwise I love those with Tito, yeah.
All right, so let's do this kind of what-if quick before we get to the feud itself. Pete, if Steamboat can't – say he gets hurt or something, right, and he's out of the picture for three, who give me a guy on the roster that you would have thought could have slotted nicely into this feud heading into to Pontiac.
Okay, let me think here. Okay, they already had Tito, so that's not going to work.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if they were able to bring in a Rick Martel.
Well, he was there, but he was in a tag team.
Yeah, maybe break him out as a single star. I mean,
that would have been pretty awesome, I'm sure, yeah.
How about you, Kelly?
I think him and Steamboat have similar match psychology.
An alternate to Steamboat.
And,
Billy Durkane.
Instead of doing the throat angle, then maybe they could have, like, scarred up Martel's face or something.
No, don't you touch that face.
That's the thing, man. Funny.
It's beautiful.
And Barb would have cried. And they could have changed the course of history.
All right, Kelly, besides Billy Durkane, who do you have as an option?
Well, you can't go to Tito. Who else
Dominic
could they have?
Dominic coming out of retirement.
They could have, yeah, you know.
One final run.
he was feuding with Bruno, so they could have maybe did like an offshoot feud there where he took out Dom to get to Bruno.
Bruno that's was our WrestleMania 2 rebook. That was my match right there. Bruno Savage at 2.
No, that's my choice, Bruno, because they did have some house shows.
Yeah, that's
house,
right
house
there.
Matches. Because they built up after, you know, when Bruno choked him. They said, "You slime, are you happy with yourself, you slime?" So they built up.
Yeah.
They had some house shows, so
yeah.
I would have went with Bruno, but
Bruno in three. Yeah, huh? What do you think,
yeah,
Scott?
That would have.
Jake.
So you go Jake face anyway, and then have their Saturday's main event rematch,
and then ditch that shit show of a
hockey,
of that honky debacle. Yeah.
Right.
How about Pedro?
Pedro never gotten broken his neck either, you know.
Fucking Pedro.
No Pedro.
We've already seen him beat Savage.
Yeah, I think Jake would have been a good one. I was gonna say Piper, but then I just realized that Piper was actually leaving. The retirement was not kayfabe. He was leaving, so Piper wouldn't have. Although Piper Savage would have been fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, I was thinking of Piper too. Yeah, I think Piper would have been awesome.
But he wasn't leaving, and oh well. I mean, unless Savage keeps the belt. That's the thing. Do we that
you
opens
can't have
up
Piper lose though? You'd have to have made it non-title or something.
Yeah. So if you're talking about a title change,
yeah, I mean, I'm just talking the same exact story. You know, I'm not saying the throat thing, but a feud starts. Steamboat gets hurt in like September, and he's going to miss. So you got to rebook this feud with somebody else to lead to the title change. I'm saying so. I think Jake and I like the Bruno one. I think Jake's a good one. I like Martel in a vacuum. I just don't know if they would have had time to build him up as a legit threat. I mean, we just talked about how well built Steamboat had been leading up to this. So, all right, let's quickly discuss the feud itself. We don't have to talk yet about the footage we watched. We'll save that for a minute. But just Kelly, the feud itself leading up to Pontiac with these two guys. Like, where does the feud rank? The build? Did they make any missteps? Like, what's your hype level going into that show? Just kind of talk about that from that perspective.
I think it was, it was almost perfect. It was, you know, probably the most anticipated feud for me going into WrestleMania 3, because even then I was more into the IC level guys. I was super into Savage, super into Steamboat. The angle on TV was incredible. It was the first like real big serious angle that I saw as a fan in real time. And it was just on a Saturday, and you know, I thought, you know, Steamboat was almost dead. You know, the guy, I totally believed that. It scared me. It was terrifying, the whole throat thing. And yeah, slowly he is able to come back. He returns, and Savage had held the belt for a year, so that meant a lot. The title switch. And yeah, it was a really, really well done build, I thought. I don't know. You don't want to, like, I'm always for, you know, don't overbook things. You don't have to have too many angles. One really strong angle is usually enough. And then let them do the rest, do it in the ring and draw the big crowd and have an amazing match to blow it all off. And yeah,
I love the uniqueness, how it came out of just like a basic match. Like usually like an angle comes out of like a pit, you know, a Piper's pit or a snake pit or something, you know, goofy that's staged on a Cindy show. But here, this just came out of a basic match. And then all of a sudden it just took a left turn and just went ballistic and went too violent. And it was rare that, you know, an angle would come out of like a match like that. So that's what I love to do, is unique. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think, Scott?
No, I like the fact that it came from a match as well. And Steamboat's just such an easy guy to obviously show sympathy towards, because it's Ricky Steamboat. But I think Jay could have definitely slipped into that role pretty comfortably as well. But I like, John, I like your point that instead of a pit that had, you know, or the, you know, where it was kind of set up with guys standing there and everything, the fact that they melded it into a match is a big, I thought was a big deal too.
Pete, what did you think of the feud?
I love the feud. And, coming out of the angle of the match was incredible. I mean, Steamboat, of course, was incredible selling that bell shot. But you, as a fan watching it, you can believe that Randy Savage is such a total scumbag that you bought him completely trying to destroy Steamboat's Larynx. I mean, it was just, it was a character he was a character you knew enough about that you knew this guy just wasn't on the up and up. He was always abusing his beautiful manager slash whatever. And you totally bought into it. The only misstep I thought they had was, and it didn't show up on this footage, but I remember originally when I saw it, is that Steamboat's selling and wailing around so quickly that he ends up whacking some fan in the face when he squirm in. And I think they got sued for that. But other than that, I thought this was just tremendous.
Vince and Jesse were incredible during that match, selling it. Like, Vince was like, Steamboat can't breathe. And Jesse was like, whoa. And, you know, Jesse was all happy. He was like cheering on his boy Macho, and, you know, and almost killing Steamboat. They were in rare form in that match.
Yeah, you know, there's nothing wrong with putting stuff over the top, and because you know what, you remember it. I mean, we're remembering this stuff from 20 some odd years, 30 some odd years ago, and it's because, I mean, yeah, sure, we just watched the footage, but you still remember Vince's call, Steamboat can't breathe.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yep.
That's what got to me. That's what scared the shit out of me.
Yeah, me too.
He made it real.
Mm-hmm. All right, so. Kelly, you made us a wonderful playlist of matches to watch and items to watch to lead up, that led up to the kind of discussion around this topic. So I'm going to turn things to you to take control here. Do you want to kind of walk us through one by one what you had us watch, and then we can just kind of talk about our thoughts on this footage we checked out for the Savage Steamboat feud?
Yeah. So, yeah, I you know, there's a lot of matches out there from the house shows between these two guys that are available. So there was quite a few to choose from, and at different locations too. You have Toronto, you have Philly. They did work in Boston in late 85, actually. But they never worked at Madison Square Garden one-on-one, which is kind of odd, maybe.
Do you feel like they were protecting it because they knew that was more visibly seen and they didn't want the match out there? That maybe they felt the other towns or cities were less likely to be seen on a wider level heading into Mania?
Yeah, I think when you got close to Mania, yeah, you didn't want to put that on the Garden show.
Yeah.
But when, you know, when they weren't feuding and they just had these kind of random matches, it probably could have happened. It just didn't, you know, just the scheduling just didn't work out. The first match they ever
had. It was a hot angle, so they could definitely sell out a lot of the smaller buildings with it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. The first match they ever had against each other was the Wrestling Classic tournament match. That we've all seen, I'm sure. Nothing too memorable. The whole card was full of matches, not too memorable. Rushed and all that. But that was the first time they ever wrestled. So that was November 85. Then December 7th at the Boston Garden, December 7th, 1985.
That was my fifth birthday, by the way, that day.
Oh, that's funny, because the first one we're going to talk about for our, from the playlist was on my 9th birthday, July 27th.
There you go.
at Maple Leaf Gardens. Yeah, so yeah, they had that early match at the Wrestling Classic, then won the next month at the Boston Garden. Then I don't think they really worked that much until the summer of 86 in Toronto, where they had this random one. Steamboat was in the middle of his feud with Roberts at this time, and Savage was feuding... well, with a bunch of people, Steel, Santana, Bruno, and they had this match at Maple Leaf Gardens, 1986, July 27th, like I said. This was on the Best of the WWF Volume 9.
That would be buried somewhere, huh? That's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, I saw it back then, whenever that would have been, because I rented all those tapes numerous times. There was a few clips in this match, but nothing I don't think that detracted from it or anything. The quality from Daily Motion, unfortunately, was a little less than great, but oh well. I think the work went through and it was no problem. So yeah, do you want to talk about this one, or should I highlight some of the other ones I picked?
We can talk about this one for a minute if you want to give us some thoughts.
Yeah, because this was outside of the feud, right? This was before the feud, when they'd only worked a handful of times against each other. And I hadn't seen this match in years. when I watched it the other day, and I really enjoyed this one. I thought it was gritty. Savage gets busted open. The crowd heat was awesome. You know, Toronto is always just such a hot crowd. And Steamboat, back in the 70s, late 70s, was a star in Toronto because Toronto was a Crockett city beginning in the late 70s and up until 84. And Steamboat and Flair did huge business in Toronto in the late 70s. So the city knew him from then. I really, really enjoyed this one.
One thing you really noticed about Steamboat in those Toronto towns is because of the past history. In some of the towns, you get a split where Savage was kind of had a cult following. But here, there was none of that in Toronto. This was clearly a Ricky Steamboat town.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was a huge Steamboat chance throughout. He was so over. Yeah, this was a great match. I gave it 4 stars. Really, really good work from both guys, brawling outside the ring. And the finish was, it was a typical screwy non-finish for when you have a guy with a title, you're not going to have anything conclusive. So, but yeah, I really like this one. Thoughts, gentlemen?
It was a solid match. It was definitely a solid match. Yeah. No, I liked it overall. You could tell the chemistry was there and something could be worked down the pipe, but I definitely, this was definitely one that I think Vince, the bookers, the backstage guys, Pat and them probably said to Vince, look, these guys could be something special down the line. Give them their time to develop themselves in other ways and let's get back to this because this is one we shouldn't forget. And I think this match was the beginning of that, Pete.
Yeah, definitely. It was definitely one of the matches that, as they would say, sold out the curtain, where I'm sure all the boys were out there checking it out, seeing probably the two of the best workers in the company go after it. And they worked it completely different than the match we'd see in Mania. This was more of a psychology base with you see Steamer working the arm and Savage, incredible selling, which is, Savage arguably could be the greatest, one of the greatest, easily one of the top 10 sellers of all time. And I will say, the backslide battle here was one of the best backslide
That was great.
I've ever seen in my life.
That was really cool.
I like the blood part too. I mean, that was great. Like the blade job really sold. It made Steamboat be such a badass. And like you said, this is even before the heat. The heated feud. So I mean, this is just like really fired up Steamboat looking for this title, and just it lets you know right away that what's going to come is that Steamboat is. So, wants a title and Savage just has a death grip on it. And now we're going to pile on the story on top of it, which we'll get to. I thought the blood really enhanced it here. It didn't feel gratuitous. It felt like it counted.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, off topic. At Maple Leaf Gardens, is it true that they had to build the ramp in order to protect the wrestlers from getting spit on and pissed on from the unruly lowlife Toronto fans? Is it true that they had to protect them? That's why they built that ramp?
I mean, that's as good a theory as any I've heard. They had the ramp. I've seen pictures from the 1960s, and the ramp was there then. Like, it was always there for whatever reason. it could very well be something like that, totally. I don't know. Toronto didn't really have that bad of a reputation as far as unruly fans go, compared to some other cities, but
Canadian, so yeah.
They're born unruly, yeah,
I guess so. Snowballs, maybe.
Throw a beer at you, eh?
Yeah, Molson Stubbies.
All right, what was this next match we watched, Cal?
Okay, so, I wanted to check out some different venues and also a match that I'd never seen before. And so now we're into after the angle. The angle was taped in late October, I believe, and aired probably I think it had quite a lag after the throat injury angle. I think it was almost 3 weeks because they actually wrestled quite a few times after they taped the injury angle because it hadn't aired.
So it was taped on October 28th in Binghamton. It aired November 22nd.
Yeah, wow. So they're more than 3 weeks. So they worked quite a few shows in November with the crowds being totally ignorant of what had happened in Binghamton. So Steamboat came back to work the house shows in late December, I think December 27th, 86, in East Lansing, Michigan, was his first match back. And, of course, it was against Savage. Right. These guys are married now for, like, 3 straight months.
Except for Science Man Event, where Savage fights Steel, like, twice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was Savage's, only other opponent, basically. If you look at the results, almost every night it was Savage and Steamboat. And then in March, when they get into March, they did a bunch of tag matches, 6-man tags, the elimination tag that we saw, and then a lot of just straight 2-on-2 tags too, with like JYD involved and other guys. So this one, January 10th, 87 from the Spectrum in Philly. And they worked the Spectrum, I want to say 3 straight shows. There's a December, a January, and a February with this run with these two guys. I've seen the February show, and I'll talk a bit about that in a moment. But I'd never seen this match before. And it is what it is. It's perfect as like a setup for a blood or like a more intense match. Like this was the first match back. The crowd at Philly is crazy, and Savage is running away a lot at first. It's not very long. It ends up with the ref like losing control. Steamer brings in the chair, knocks down the referee, and looking at it as far as like the first match back after a big angle, I think it's perfectly fine because Steamboat's too overzealous. He wants revenge. And he lets his emotions get the better of him, and the match is thrown out. Nothing's settled, nothing's resolved, and that's how you draw a house for the next month, because you know they're going to come back and presumably have a much more violent encounter, a longer encounter, and perhaps a decisive encounter. So I was pleasantly surprised with this match, because I've never heard it talked up anywhere. I don't know about you, Pete, if this is something that you were really aware of.
Okay, well, I'll say Ricky Steamboat's my favorite wrestler, so I've seen all these stuff ad nausea. But with that said, you hit it on the head where this is him going for revenge. And, as of like maybe 10 years ago, we didn't have all this stuff to really flesh out this feud. All we really had was the injury angle, and then they jumped to, for the most part, because it wasn't on, they didn't feud in MSG, so it was hard to get your hands on a lot of this stuff. And so you just fast forward to WrestleMania 3, and a lot of people's arguments was, man, for a guy who got his larynx crushed, he sure doesn't seem like he hates Randy Savage really that right. much in that WrestleMania 3 match. But here, okay, this is part one. The finish here is perfect. He's going after Savage with a chair. He wants revenge. The key of this feud, then, is you get to that February footage, which we'll talk about from Toronto, where he busts Savage open. He's building the whole match around revenge spots of choking Savage's larynx. And so that match, even though he loses, he gets his revenge. And now, WrestleMania 3 is the final phase of this feud, where he's had his revenge. He's bloodied up Savage, and now he's going to take his title. So it all goes into this. It comes and makes the feud flow so much better when you get all this, like these little glimpses into the feud, which we used to never have. And so it's really important these footage that you pulled that they finally because of this, all the services WWF is doing now, from a lot of this stuff popped up on 24/7, and it allowed us to actually. To take in the grandeur of this whole entire feud and understand it a lot better.
Yeah, that's a perfect enlightenment, Pete. Basically, it shows how he beat him up all around the world, and now come WrestleMania, he just wants the title. He's did everything he can. He's taken everything except the belt.
Yep.
And also it helps because it was bittersweet. Like we'll see, like the aftermath, because pretty much WrestleMania 3 is it. I mean, we don't really see them two anymore, so which is always bittersweet.
Interesting note on this that Graham has, Kelly, is that It says Steamboat was subbing for Andre in this match. Was that a fake sub? Was it ever supposed to actually be Andre? Was that a, you know, you think it was just
bait
like
switch, if you will?
Yeah, like, well, yeah. Was it an on purpose bait and switch? Right. So were they, you know, were they never actually planning to have Andre there, but they were trying to cover that because Steamboat came back officially on TV. He came back what at Saturday's main event, right? January 3rd. So maybe the announced match was Andre just to cover that it was going to be Steamboat, so they didn't give away that he was coming back. Something like that, maybe.
That's very possible, because I'm pretty sure Andre didn't wrestle after the Machine's gimmick until WrestleMania 3. Like, he was totally, other than the Battle Royal.
Because if you look at Quebec, in Montreal, January 9th, it's the same thing. It says Steamboat subbing for Andre the Giant, who gave his title shot to Steamboat. New Haven, January 8th, it doesn't have that caveat. But it, oh, here we go. Yeah. Hartford has it. So, yeah, it may have been the gimmick they were running, that it was supposed to be Andre. And
a surprise substitute. Yeah,
surprise
substitute. Yeah. The fans wouldn't shit on Steamboat as a surprise because they want to
not
see
at all. Yeah, right. Not at all. Right.
Yeah, it's an improvement on the advertised match, even though it was Andre originally. That's crazy.
So the
Andre had asked Pedro first, Kelly, and Pedro. Was, Andre thought it was 1980. So.
Yeah, it was interesting that, so Steamboat came back on that Saturday's main event, and then, so, of course, Savage by Steel, and then in the next one in March that we just talked about last week, or a couple weeks ago, Scott, that was Savage Steel again. That was for the services of Elizabeth and the title, and Steamboat is obviously involved there as well. So, on national TV, they were given some rub to the feud, but, Scott, just quick, your thoughts on this Philly match before we get to the next one.
Oh, it was very good. I thought the Toronto one was a little better, but I think it served its purpose and continued what was going to be an excellent build and would lead into what we would see. But no, it was very good. I liked it. I thought Toronto was a little better, but I liked it.
Okay, so then we get to the last match before WrestleMania 3, and it's back in Toronto February 15th. And the funny thing about this is they wrestled in Philly on Valentine's Day, the day before. And this match, that match is available. It's out there. And it's like night and day with this match in Toronto. Mm-hmm. Like, the Toronto match is violent, bloody, crazy. The Philly match the day before is surprisingly tame and almost boring at times.
It felt like the Philly match might have been one of the ones that they always talk about in the shoot interviews of where they were trying out aspects of the WrestleMania match.
Yeah, that's a good point, because it's totally different.
More mat based and a lot of two counts and less like violence and more traditional wrestling moves.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was that they were trying to, because the WrestleMania 3, one of the hallmarks there is all the two counts, right? And so to John's point, you know, maybe here they're focusing on that aspect of the match, like, all right, how are we going to work all the flurry of two counts in here? And saving the heated part. So that could be a part of it.
Yeah, no, I think those are very good points. But anyway, so in Toronto, this match is become kind of legendary in certain circles. A lot of people say, oh, it's better than the Mania match.
I'm one of them people.
Oh, really? Okay.
Tell us why, Pete. Tell us why.
It's the violence. I absolutely love the violence to it. It's something to do. I like the violence. This is Steamboat going for revenge as a revenge match, which is needed in the feud. I love Savage going after the throat. So this is all personal stuff. And Steamer's revenge sparks are aimed at Savage's neck. Steamer is really kicking the living shit out of Savage throughout the match. Steamboat's comeback is full of piss and vinegar, and again, right after those freaking going after Savage's throat, Savage bleeding, you see Steamer just going after that cut, and then you get the post-match fight afterwards. Yeah, I just liked everything about it, man. It was more of, I love the WrestleMania match, but on this thing, I can watch this a lot and not, you know, once you, I think WrestleMania 3 is one of them great matches you've seen. It will always be a great match, but the first time you see the WrestleMania 3 match, it really pops you the most because of all the near falls. but it loses luster over time because you know it's coming. Violence never loses its luster to me because it's almost like the WrestleMania one was more of like a high spot versus this storyline that was more personal. But I can totally understand why other people think the WrestleMania one is on a bigger stage. It's on the one of the greatest. It's on at that point the greatest WrestleMania up to that point, the biggest selling WrestleMania of all time for the longest time. So I mean, I can understand why I'm in the minority on this. But for me, the February 15th match, just because of how personal it got, it really typified what the feud was truly about, which was hatred, and then it became about the title.
All right, yeah. Kelly, why don't you give your thoughts now since I hijacked yours with Pete?
No, that's fine. No, I that was great. It flowed perfectly there. The first time I saw this, yeah, because it was such a revelation. It was like, wow, there was actually, you know, a match before WrestleMania 3 between these guys that is arguably is as good or better. And like Pete said, like all these matches were, you know, hard to come by before. The WWF, WWE didn't put them out on tape or on DVD, really. It wasn't until the services came about and then YouTube. So this was quite a revelation seeing this match. Yeah, I love it. It's a great match. Blood, it's a personal, you know, vendetta by Steamboat. You get the near falls at the end that you would get at WrestleMania 3. Not as many of them, but some of them. The crowd was biting on them, too. I thought that Steamboat was going to win, and the crowd was just ready to blow the roof off Maple Leaf Gardens if Steamboat would have won the title that night. But then Savage wins in a great way with the tainted win with the tights being held. And
he there's bled. No George Steele in there either.
Yeah, no George. That's a good point. You got blood, you got no Steele. But as for WrestleMania 3, well, I mean, it's iconic. It happened on the biggest stage ever. It upstaged the main event in so many ways. It was a match. A lot of people hadn't seen that kind of match before because WWF wasn't known for the work rate matches necessarily, especially on the big shows like the WrestleManias. So seeing a match like that with all the two counts and kickouts, you know, for years when I was, you know, 5 years later, we were doing my friends and I, we were doing trampoline wrestling in one of my friend's backyard, actually Travis's from Lucha Afterground, his backyard. We were copying the Steamboat Savage match from WrestleMania 3 more than any other match. We were always doing the 1-2 kick out, 1-2 kick out, the roll ups and all that. Like such an influential match. Jericho's written about how, you know, he and one of his friends, you know, memorized the match and would perform it, right? It was so influential, transcendent. And, you know, yeah, it's still to this day one of my favorite matches. Like, I love watching WrestleMania 3 Savage Steamboat. But the Toronto match is wonderful as well. Everyone should see it. And, yeah, like Pete said, you know, this is like seeing all these other matches makes the feud like a novel with chapters, and we got everything now, and it's glorious. It's great.
Johnny, what'd you think of the Toronto match? And compare it to, I mean, don't give too many thoughts on three since you'll be with us next week, but just your thoughts on this one in general comparison.
Yeah, I mean, up until this point, we haven't seen maybe Tito and the Hammer. We haven't seen like a series of matches where two guys with the work rate and the technical moves, we haven't seen it. Other than, you know, possibly Tito Hammer, because at this point the WWF was more the big characters and more brawling and kind of like, you know, moments, but nothing like this that we haven't seen like work rate like this. So this is just groundbreaking between these two.
What do you think, Scott?
It was good. I mean, I still think the first Toronto match was better, but it definitely sets up. Could they top this, or could they have a different kind of match at WrestleMania? So it definitely sets up for what lies ahead. Incidentally, I actually went to the taping the next night, February 16th, which was a Monday, and in New Haven. So I got to see the guys the next night. They were in jobber squashes, but it was pretty cool. But we're all set and ready to go. So I think it was a perfect last chapter before the the big finale.
All right, Kelly, is that did we cover everything we watched?
Yeah, I think okay. I think we did. Yeah, we're pretty good here.
All right, so since you and Pete aren't going to be with us next week, real quick, you don't have to give any context. Star rating: Savage Steamboat, WrestleMania 3, Kelly.
I gotta say 5. I haven't watched it in several years, probably, but I haven't given any match 5 stars yet. But I think just the transcendent nature of it. That I'm a sucker for that, the match that has something that other matches don't have and just becomes special and becomes part of history. So yeah, I have to drop 5 on that one.
Pete,
I have 4.5.
Okay. All right, we'll be interesting to see where we all fall next week. So what do we do? Let's take a break. We'll grab a drink, take a piss, relax. We'll ignore the Killer Bees as they go on fight the Four Legion. And then we'll come back, and we're going to talk to Big Daddy of them all, Hulk Hogan versus Andre the Giant. We're going to go through our thoughts on the feud, where it stood, and as well as some really cool footage that Kelly put together for us to cover their history together. So we'll cover all that when we come back right after the break.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on 3 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all of these shows, plus others available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey, this is Dr. Tom Pritchard, and you're listening to the Place to Be podcast on the Place to Be Nation.
All right, Nation, we're back. Episode 470 of the Place to Be podcast, looking at the build, the hype, the road to WrestleMania 3. Scott, you enjoying this trip down memory lane as we tee up for next week?
Oh, I'm pumped. I was pumped about it when I was watching the stuff today and realizing I went to a very important, as I alluded to in the first segment, I went, and I remember the date very, very well because it's my first live taping at my home base, the now demolished New Haven Coliseum, and it was February 16th, 1987. It was a, I don't know if it was Superstars or Challenge. One of the two. I think it was Superstars. And so, you know, I sat there, my dad and I sat there and watched like 37 matches, 32 of them squashes. I did get a Hogan Hercules match that night and about eight pits, which we'll document in this segment because most of the pits that we watched leading up to this feud were on that night. So early. But it brings me back to watching all the stuff live you know, now we talked about the biggest mid card feud going into Pontiac. Now we're going to talk about the feud that, you know, sold the tickets.
Did you do that often? Go one of them, go to a TV taping, because I never ever wanted to go to a TV taping in my entire life of the WWF.
No, I did. I went to a few. They were cheap. I mean, for 1987 standards, I guess. I think I used to sit in the crap seats at the Coliseum, so it was probably like, I don't know, $9 or something, but you know, it was pretty cool. It was cool to watch all the squashes. And
did people complain that it was too long? Well, yeah. Amazing how history repeats itself.
I can't believe I have to watch 37 matches for $9. You know,
it's like, you know, it's funny. My memory of my first show was always that it was a TV taping in Providence, but I don't know. Looking at Graham's site, I don't. No, because you would have had all the details. So I guess it just seemed like a long night. Maybe I had never been to one before, and it was a church group that a family friend of ours were going to. I had just started watching, and I tagged along, and it had to be Warrior Perfect was the main event. So it was either this April 21st, 1990, or there was one in May that also had Warrior Perfect. So I'm not sure which one it was, but in my mind, it was always a TV taping. So actually, I don't know if I've ever been to one either where they did all the long taping.
In the 90s, they probably just cut it down to maybe like three or four episodes.
Yeah.
But I think the 80s, like Scott said, they would do like eight.
Yeah.
Like eight superstars. Yeah.
I mean, they did like five pits that night. It was crazy. Yeah. And that's when I finally...
That was like 5 or 6 hours here or there, right?
Yeah, I got there. Let's put it this way. I probably got there like 6:30, quarter to 7, and I'm pretty sure we didn't leave till like 11:30. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it was a long night. Well, my dad wasn't thrilled. Neither was I at the end, because I getting up at, you know, 6:15 to go to school. It was not easy for a 13-year-old. But it was great, though. It was pretty cool.
All right, so before we dive any deeper, I do want to do a quick plug. Brand new podcast coming. It's an existing podcast with a new concept. Our buddy Glenn Butler in the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular has a new format, at least for this episode coming, where our good friend, the conscience of Place to Be Nation, as Scott Criscolo calls him, Steve Willey, who of course is a professional mind bender, is joining Glenn for a special advice show, and they're asking for your questions on any topic, any realm, any walk and way of life that you would like to hear from Steve and Glenn, two very thoughtful, provocative, and innovative thinkers. Get those questions in. The email address is, did he put it in here, Scott? Yes, he did. Spectacularadvice@gmail.com. So spectacularadvice@gmail.com. Or they created an Ask FM account if you want to do your question anonymously at ask.fm/spectacularadvice. So they're looking for any questions you want advice on in your personal life. It could just be, you know, horse hockey. It could be real, whatever you want it to be. Those two guys are going to take some time and answer those questions. Again, two great minds coming together. Two guys that give a lot of great advice, too. So if you are a little torn on something in your life and you want some advice from a professional and a guy that kind of acts like a professional, you can figure out which is which. You can go ahead and submit a question for them, and they'll go ahead and answer for you. So check that out. Should be a lot of fun. Can't wait to listen to it. So one question we can submit to them is, what match did you like better, Hulk Hogan versus Andre or Savage Steamboat? The question that has torn many people in Placement Nation apart over the years. But we are going to take a moment now to break down the build to Hogan-Andre. John, let's start with you. Andre the Giant, was he out of steam as a face? Was this heel turn needed? Was this a must to keep Andre relevant? Or could they have kept keeping on the way he was into perpetuity until he had to retire, just as kind of the, you know, whatever you want to call it, the ambassador face of the WWF?
Oh, yes, definitely, because there was no more... There were pretty much no more giant heels for him to oppose. Mm-hmm. I don't know where they were going with the...
Well, hold on. So actually, don't take it from Hogan's point of view. Take it from Andre's point of view. Did you say there's no more muscle? Did you mean for Andre or for Hogan?
No, for Andre.
Okay, all right. Shut up. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was no more like Bundys or studs. There was nobody even close. Kamala was in around, but he had already been there and done that. So there was really nothing. I was really wondering, I mean, this what eventually happened was a shock, but I was wondering where they were going with, like, Heenan's trying to get him reinstated. I was thinking that maybe it was going to be Studd and Patera were going to, you know, come back, which wouldn't have been much, and maybe they'll have, like, a handicap match with Studd and Patera. Like, Heenan was going to set up something where Andre was reinstated, and then Studd and Patera would come back, you know, because they were gone and they were jumping, which, you know, wouldn't have been much, but maybe, like, a handicap match. So I had no idea about this. But, yeah, there was nowhere for Andre to go, because there's no more monster heels left for him to face Andre as a face.
What do you think, Scott? You agree?
Yeah. I mean, we talked about it on these vaults as we got into the end of the calendar year, 86. I mean, Studd was worn out. Bundy was pretty much worn out. Who was left? I mean, really nobody. And I'm sure the time off that Andre had towards the back end of 86 after the machines kind of fizzled out, this might have been the discussion. I mean, I know he was doing Princess Bride and all that, but I think it was just a question of how much Andre had left in the tank. I think it was more health than anything else.
Yeah.
Obviously, you could tell by WrestleMania 2, he was hurting. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, he was hurting during that battle royal in Chicago. So the clock was ticking on him.
There's a huge difference between, like you see, like, some of the matches, like Andre had, like, 84, late 84, 85 with Kamala, where he was doing, like, you know, second row splashes, and then a big difference between, like, you know, the 86 battle royal and from here, where he could barely move. That 2 years was, like, for Andre, that was, like, 20 years for him, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you 100%, John. And that's, I think, the problem is, there was no, now here's an interesting thing. According to Flair, I mean, I don't want to go off topic, but this does kind of relate on Flair, on the 30 for 30 Flair. He said that there were two opportunities in the '80s for him to, come to the WWF. 88, which is one that's kind of been documented, actually.
Well, he talked about it in his book. It was going to be for SummerSlam against Savage.
Yeah, it was going to be 80. So 88's not a secret. Mm-hmm. But I didn't hear until that 30 for 30 that he may have come in 86, which is perplexing, because that was the year that he was supposed to – that was the big year for Magnum before he, you know, made love to a telephone pole. So if Flair was coming at the back end of 86, was it going to be Hogan Flair in – at Pontiac? You know?
I mean, it's definitely possible.
If that was plan A, and Hogan and Andre turning heel was plan B, Maybe that's why. Maybe Andre was his original plan.
I mean, it may not have been plan A, right? It could have just been, who knows when in 86 it was. I mean, it could have just been Vince putting feelers out to say, hey, Flair, I know you're, you know, maybe he's working on a handshake or verbal or whatever. What do you think? So it might not have been something where it was penciled in for a Mania match or anything like that. It could have just been, hey, you know, maybe someone talked to him. Like, had anyone jumped recently from the NWA there? Like, that could have told Vince, like, hey, you know, Flair's, you know, Flair's open if you want to talk to him, something like that. So it could have just been a conversation. And maybe Flair had, maybe Vince offered him saying, hey, if you want to come, it's yours. I mean, maybe that's what Flair meant. I don't know if it was actually ever something that was, like, penciled in for a big-time match, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think Vince had discussions with almost every big star in Crockett in 86 at one point.
Right.
But they were making good money, and they didn't have to leave at that point.
Yeah, I'm shocked that Nikita never made Nikita a Koloff over there.
Yeah, that's one. Yeah, for sure. Midnight Express and Cornette had a meeting in Stamford. I know about that. And I think the Road Warriors were offered quite a lot of money too, of course. But yeah.
So, Kelly, flipping the question I asked John and Scott, was Andre needed for Hogan coming into three? Was there anyone else believable that could have been in that spot? Like, so obviously I think we all agree. I know you guys didn't answer the question, but I think we all agree that Andre was probably at the end of the road as a face. But from Hogan's point of view, was Andre a savior? Like, where was he headed at three? Were we going to get more fucking Paul Arndorf? Or, you know, like, what else, what possibly could have brought us to WrestleMania three with Hogan?
Yeah, they could have held off on the blow off to Arndorf that they had on Saturday Night's main event. Because that was a hot feud.
Could it have lasted all that time, you think? Another 2 months?
I think so. You know, because I don't think when the cage match happened that it felt like, oh, we have to end this. You know, it's been going on too long. I think it was still pretty hot at that point.
Either that or they could have done the Orndorff turn later. Like,
Yeah, exactly.
But they could have done it like in January. They could have done it in January instead of the summer. Yeah, do it in January.
Fill into that stadium. I mean, having to hold it off. I mean, I think it's easier to start a feud off, which is kind of what they did with Andre there at Mania, than actually have one that's been ongoing and then to be in the blow off. Because I think it'd been a tough sell to get 100,000 people in that building with Orndorff.
I think that's the only thing close, that if they did the Orndorff turn in like January, and if it was hot, and their first match was Mania, they could have came close to doing it.
Okay, I can see that on the time frame.
Yeah, I mean, and they'd run it on the house shows, and yeah, Mania was going to be something fresh. I don't know when the Silverdome was booked exactly. I don't know if it was really booked that far in advance.
Yeah, it's not like now where they do it like a year and a half or 2 years. It was pretty much, from what I remember, WrestleMania was still in the infancy, so you didn't really think about it.
Like, oh, yeah, they sure. Yeah,
so it was pretty much like, okay, we're going to enjoy the holidays, and then after Christmas, we'll come up with something for WrestleMania.
Yeah, sure as hell we're getting quartered to come to town, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, definitely. It was definitely after Christmas that it was announced.
All of a sudden, January, it's like, okay, we got to come up with something for WrestleMania.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah. It probably wasn't really thought of until the new year. And, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of factors. Andre being broken down was a big one because he'd already done like his farewell tour internationally in 86. He put over Inoki in Japan. I think he put over El Canek in Mexico. So he was done doing any kind of touring and he was broken down. And yeah, it was perfect for him to do this heel turn, to have this mega match and not have to do another round of monster house shows with some monster. You know, it was time for Andre to change.
I'm going to throw this out. I know JR's going to get pissed, but I think it's a good question to ask. If we're talking about alternative options, if Andre was not viable or whatever, to add juice going into WrestleMania 3,
OJ?
Was it better? I kill you!
His whole life could have went differently if he showed up at WrestleMania. Maybe none of that happens.
Yeah, he was such a baby face in 1987. He would have to tag with Hogan. Not
he was hot off the Nick of Gunn, man.
That's right. Nordberg.
Nick Gunn wasn't until 89-ish, I think.
The only thing I could see, if we're talking about other options, to make WrestleMania 3 something juicy is have Hogan chase instead of having the belt already.
No.
You love this
God
scenario.
God damn it. We've talked about this so many fucking
times.
You
love Hogan.
No, but you can't. But no. No, but here's the thing.
No.
Now you're talking. Okay, so empty every option. What does he do? Play with himself? Play with Nordberg?
Him defending against anyone is better than him losing the title
no.
and chasing.
Wrong answer. No.
No, it's the correct answer.
No, 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 no.
I'm not big on killing the golden goose.
No, no, cut the golden goose crap. That's crap. That's crap. That's crap. It doesn't matter. So Hogan has to have a belt to make money by this point? No, I'm staying on this. You guys can fight me all you want. All
right, we're good. So quick straw poll. Pete, would it have been a better idea for Hogan to fight someone else or to lose the title and chase it to WrestleMania 3?
He'd been better fighting Steve Lombardi than losing the title.
Oh, Kelly. You guys are full of shit. Full of shit.
Kelly, what would have been better, him in the midget Absolutely match with not. Bundy or losing the title and chasing it?
Little Beaver.
Rematch to WrestleMania 2 in a midget tag.
D'Amato, what do you think?
Your cred's right in the toilet.
Sorry, Scott.
No, nah, you're all idiots. No, nah, you're all stupid.
All right, who's he dropping the title to for this hot chase?
Who cares?
Little Beaver.
Okay.
Pick one.
Beaver.
Pick one.
Honky?
Maybe Orndorff beats him in the cage. Or beats him non-cage match at Saints main event. And you set up a cage.
You're not taking the belt off Hogan. So here's a name we haven't talked about. What about if they didn't, I know it's tough because you're running the risk in the big dome of things not going away crowd-wise. Because he was getting cheered over Hulk in the fall, and then he had to turn face to Jake Roberts. Could they have kept Jake heel long enough? Could they have kept him hot but cool enough where he's not getting out popping Hogan and had that be the WrestleMania 3 match, and then Jake turns face after that?
I don't think Jake is a ninety thousand dollars.
Well, I don't think anyone is. In fairness, besides Andre, I don't even exactly. If Hogan's chasing. I mean, nobody is.
Yeah, you got to think the time frame. Hogan was larger than life. So the heels needed to be big guys. Savage was the exception.
Not only big in size, but big in like stature, like somebody like Andre level.
Yes. But most of the guys. I don't think Jake was there big yet. Boys.
Yeah. All right, so it sounds like that's it. It's Andre. I mean, they're lucky they did what they did because.
The roster was pretty. I mean, the main event level by the end of '86 was pretty bad. It was pretty thin. Mid-card was great. Tag was great.
Mid-card solid, but definitely there's nobody on that iconic list.
I mean, Kamala, they burned through. I don't know if Kamala would have been a viable main event option by then. Vince would have had to go, buy somebody. Mm. He would have had to go to Flair.
I think Flair, it's Andre or Flair. I mean, I think those are your options. And even Flair, I don't know if he sells out 90 because maybe you guys know better than me. I wasn't around at this point as far as a fan. But I feel like the wrestling world is more bifurcated at this point where just Flair coming in, WWF. So, I mean, what's the earliest he comes in? Say he comes in like November or something. I mean, how early can you start the feud? So say they start it in January. Is there enough, heat? Did enough WWF fans know who Ric Flair is to sell out 90,000?
I honestly think they do better selling working an angle with Nikita Koloff.
Russian xenophobic stuff. Yeah,
they could have done it. Possibly. If Flair would have came in with as the NWA champion, even then, I don't think they could have done 90,000.
Yeah,
but that wasn't their MO at the time to just bring somebody and shoot them to the top. I mean, they didn't do that.
Yeah,
but unless it was Hogan.
Right,
he won the title. Right,
but he had been around before anyway, so at least he wasn't completely new. I guess Flair was there for a cup of coffee, but all right, Kelly, is there any part of this feud that you would rebook or reorganize from the way they did it, or do you think from the way it turns out, where Andre suspended and Heenan brings him back, gets him reinstated, and blah, blah, blah from there. Like, is that about as perfect as the stories they could have told with these two guys?
I think so, because, you had the history already booked, so to speak, with Andre being undefeated, Hogan being on the champ for 3 years. You know, they were the two top stars, mainstream wrestling stars of all time at that point. It was the perfect match. It was a dream match beyond dream matches. It was so big. And then you throw in an awesome angle to make everything make sense. as to why, you know, the beloved giant was now a bad guy. And you got 90,000 people, and you got the biggest show ever. Yeah, and then the Battle Royal on Saturday's main event. How great was that?
Yes.
That was so awesome. To put, you know, doubt. Oh, Hogan has no chance. Andre, look at how easily he disposed of him in the Battle Royal. No problem. You know, it was... You couldn't have booked it any better, because the history was already there. You had the story of Andre dating back to the early 70s to play off. And you had Hogan as the king of the 1980s. Andre is the king of the 70s or whatever. And the angles with the Piper's Pit and how it all turned out. Perfect. Perfect stuff. Everybody involved is just... Yeah. And yeah. There's no need to tamper with that.
What do you think, John?
A masterpiece.
It was just perfect. Instead of like a major beatdown, they made it real subtle with you just ripping the cross, and then the one bit of contact at the Battle Royal, and then that was it, because they saved it for the match. Instead of having a big beatdown angle, they saved it all for the match. And just rewatching those pits, everything was perfect. Just the foreshadowing of Andre slowly. That very first one where Hogan gets the trophy. And like him and Piper just acting like, you know, stuck up pricks, and they're all, you know, him and Piper are blowing each other about the trophy, and then here comes Andre coming from behind and just slaps him in the back, and all of a sudden they're like freaking scared shit, because, you know, and Andre is acting like such a dick, and he looks at the trophy, and what does he say, Scott?
3 years as champion. It's a long time.
Right. And as he's saying it, the camera zooms in on his big meat hook hands, and he's crushing them together like he's probably like dreaming of crushing Hogan's bald head. And then he shakes Hogan's hand, and he almost breaks Hogan's hand. And Hogan, like a little bitch, like is friggin' holding his hand. Like him and Piper are scared. Like, that was the first time that where Andre like really acted like a dick, like a bully. You know, it kind of reminded me like of the Three Stooges when Curly and Larry would be sitting there, you know, goofing off, and then Mo would come from behind and clunk their heads together, man. You know, it was like that was just such great foreshadowing. Like Hulk and Piper were just like, yeah, you know, look at all the money we're making. Where because WrestleMania, and then here comes the boss to remind them who's the friggin' boss, man.
And they kind of foreshadowed it too at MSG that we watched. I don't remember if it was before or after this pit aired, when Andre comes out and hands him the title. It was kind of like his first time back after being reinstated or whatever. Like, that was a cool foreshadow, too.
Yeah.
Speaking of that Battle Royal Saturday's main event, we did get a lot of feedback from our last show. Scott and I had asked the question why they didn't hype WrestleMania 3. And it really seems like the answer was basically that NBC asked them not to promote their other shows.
I think NBC says, hey, listen, we're not, you know, when you're little Cindy shows that you used to pay money to. We're paying you good money, and you ain't gonna friggin' use our show to hype some, you know, your little stupid show 2 months down the road. You're gonna they want to get people to watch tonight,
right?
Tonight, Saturday.
I'm not saying this to diss you, John, because you're exactly right. But that is the stupidest logic I've ever heard in my entire life.
Yeah, but
television.
It's a different world.
First of all, I thought Vince and Ebersol were like godfathers to each other. I mean, why should Dick Ebersol give a shit about pimping a pay-per-view 2 months down the road? Like, that makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, I think they just wanted to use the time. They didn't want it to be an infomercial. They wanted it to be first run live TV.
That's a precedent. That's a precedent that they're using the network to sell something that's not part of the network.
Yeah.
That they're not.
Well, yeah, that's prime real estate. That's Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, it's
live.
NBC. They want to get people to keep stay tuned that night.
Because that's why
it makes sense. I get that, but where's the logic still? It's okay. You can't mention WrestleMania 3, like, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think it's more that they wanted them, if you notice too, like, it's something we've kind of picked up on but haven't really pieced together until now, is that they almost exist in their own universe, the Saturday's main events. Like, they talk like we haven't seen them since the last Saturday's main event when they come back.
Yes, that's
and they
true.
They
yeah.
promote at the end the next when the next Saturday's main event. Like, they don't even talk about anything else. You know what I mean? So I think that's a part of it. You know, I think a big part of it is that they want to have it just exist in its own universe and not even promote
the
other stuff.
I think Vince is happy to be on national television. It's a perception thing too,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, I think he's just trusting that people will like it enough to maybe tune into the you know, other rest of the product or whatever.
Totally.
Pete.
Stupid.
Different times. Pete, talk about Bobby Heenan's role in this feud. So I thought it was a really astute point. I think Glenn Butler is really the first one I ever heard it, and I've stolen it as my own sense. But the Bobby Heenan's role as far as what he's done now to get back at Hogan, having multiple friends turn on him, coming after the title, and it all kind of ties back to WrestleMania 2, where Hogan vanquishes King Kong Bundy and then just beats the shit out of Heenan in the cage. And it's like it flipped this switch in Bobby that made him just an arch enemy Hogan. He hates Hogan so much that, well, fuck you, Hulk. I'm going to go get Paul Orndorff to turn on you and chase your title. Okay, that didn't work. I'm going to get Andre the fucking Giant to turn on you and come get your title. So, you know, it starts this like half a decade long feud between the two that kind of you can tie back to that cage beatdown that he suffers at WrestleMania 2. Had you ever felt that way with that feud? Or talk about that and then just talk about Bobby's role in general within this feud.
I always thought Heenan had almost transcended everything from the AWA when he was with Bockwinkle. Hogan was one of his arch enemies. He always had the black and blue with them, with Patera and Duncombe feuding with Hogan and partners. You see it in the WWF, and then you see it as an announcer, even in WCW, when Hogan finally turns heel, and Heenan's like, I told you so. Right. I mean, this thing transcends promotions. I mean, it's like this is like a personal feud, and I loved it because it transcended promotions. It's something. It was unilateral. Where it went just it was a straight line through everything. It was like everything else can be going on in the world, but freaking Bobby Heenan and Hulk Hogan are going to hate each other no matter what. And for some reason, I felt solace in that.
What do you think, Scott?
It was almost like, I mean, if you think about it, over this stretch, it's pretty much Bobby is Hogan's adversary and all these other guys are practically puppets. And that's where we get the whole, and I talked about this, JR, in our last episode on the Science Main Event, how Gorilla and Vince treated the feud differently, per se. And again, I think it was more because Gorilla is a former wrestler, former boy from the, you know, a guy in the back in the locker room, one of the boys, and Vince was, you know, the pasty, you know, milky announcer, that Vince always said that, yeah, okay, Bobby, you know, was the one that coerced Andre, but Andre all along was jealous, mm-hmm. jealous of all these years of the great Hulk, and how his career paled in comparison, all this other rhetoric, while Gorilla pretty much, you know, said he was disappointed in Andre, but for the most part blamed everything on Bobby. It was all Bobby's fault. Everything's Bobby's fault. And so depending on what you're watching, and this goes back to what we were saying just now about how Saran's Main Event's in a bubble, that depending on what you're watching is how you think of Andre as an opponent. Is he a bigger version of one of Bobby's puppets, or is he legitimately a, you know, 15 years and never got a title shot, and I don't know if Hogan would have said yes if I just patted him on the back and said, hey, come on, you and I wrestle for the title. No, I need Bobby to wake him up. All depends on what you're watching. So is it Hogan versus Heenan, and this is just another chapter of it, or is it Hogan versus Andre, because Andre finally said, enough is enough. I want my peace. I want my taste of the good life.
I think it's Hogan versus Heenan, but this is finally Heenan's brought in the ultimate weapon, which is, when you view it in the kayfabe thing, Hogan's been pretty much undefeated since he won the title. And they've always, the narrative was always Andre's never been pinned. I mean, which was the narrative they ran forever. So now Heenan's bringing in the ultimate weapon, the guy who's never been pinned. So who's going to win?
What do you think, Kel?
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, sorry.
Well, yeah, I mean, and the key is that Andre and Heenan had been feuding for years prior to this. And so now you get the twist where Andre is going with like his worst enemy. That was the biggest shock. Well, I mean, of course, yeah, Andre actually turning on Hogan was huge. But Andre and Heenan coming out together on Piper's Pit was, that's where my jaw dropped.
A year and a half earlier, they shaved his head.
Yeah, you know? They raped him of his dignity.
yeah,
that was the first thing Hulk said. He said, "What are you doing with him?"
Yeah, exactly.
And that really sinked it in.
They could have had
like Andre challenging him as a face, but it wouldn't have had the same effect. And what really sunk it in is putting him with Bobby, and that's what Hulk says. Hey, wait a minute, what are you doing with him?
Yeah, that's the knife in the back. Yeah.
Exactly. That meant Andre was really bad now because he was going with a guy that, you know, was out to get him for years and caused him so much misery. And now he's with Bobby Heenan. And then that just sealed the turn right there and made Andre the most hated man in wrestling overnight. Yet another integral part of the whole dynamic. Just great stuff.
Mm. By the way, Hogan, his acting... go way overexposed. I mean, he is. It's a great moment and the gravity of all, but Hogan's acting with the one where Bobby and Andre come out is so bad. He's like, Andre, say it isn't so. Why are you with him? No. I felt like I was watching fucking Thunder in Paradise. That's how just over the top he was in that moment. Again, great, great angle and great stuff, but just I sat there thinking, oh shit, this is just Hogan's just so fucking over the top at this point.
And the one where Andre on the pit, Andre gets the smaller trophy on the pit, and then friggin' Hulk comes barging in like a dick, saying, "Oh, yeah. I just wanted to say congratulate," and would let Andre just walks away. That made Hulk look like he wouldn't shut the fuck up, man.
What'd you think of Jesse in the whole thing, John?
Jesse was great. He was watching those back. I was like, Jesse was underrated. He was great, though, the way he instigated all that.
Why was he on the pit?
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. Did it seem out of place that he was there?
Because he was like a breaking news reporter. So he's like, breaking news that Andre is getting reinstated.
It's Piper's Pit. I understand it was the body shop and.
He was the guest. Yeah, like Jesse had the breaking news. He knew it all the time.
So yeah, I think you're saying like I have the inside sources telling me this. You know. Yeah.
But the other thing was they were alluding to the fact that like on the Cindy's, you know, he was whining about the trophies. You know, why is Andre's trophy, you know,
cheap
gold?
Yeah, Jesse's stirring the shit up. He was great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think
the one where him and Piper, like, you know, him, he's like, why don't we get in the ring? Even though, you know, Jesse couldn't deliver in the ring. But still, the crowd went bananas when.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Kelly, do you think those segments are as effective without Jesse?
No, he definitely added to it.
Yeah, exactly. It was another, like, look at all the Hall of Famers involved. Hogan, Andre, Piper, Heenan, Ventura. It was an all-star collection of talent. All added something to the whole picture. I mean, Jesse was probably the least, of course, least important piece, but he did add a lot to it.
And for the first time, like, Jesse finally stopped trying to put himself over. Like, even after WrestleMania 2, after Hogan defeated Bundy, Jesse's like, oh, sooner or later he's going to have to put it up against the body. But here he finally stopped putting himself over, and he said, hey, you know, Andre's the one that could take Hulk, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Pete, so heading into this match, what's the hype level? Is this the biggest match of all time in Dirty History at this point? Is this? Are you feeling it?
There's no doubt in my mind this is the biggest match in WWF history at this point. I can't even... when you think about it, in short term, there's nothing even close on paper. There's nothing...
No.
Yeah, this is... This is so much like transcends wrestling in a way. Because when you really think about it, even if you go through the whole history of the company, I can't think of a bigger main event. I mean, when you really think about it, I think this is up there. Rock and Austin?
Nah, nowhere near.
But Hogan and Andre have a lot more mythos to it. Don't get me wrong. I'm spitballing right now. But the only other thing I can think of that would be close would be Rock and Austin because they're the two greatest drawing cards in the history of the company if you want to do it versus that way. But Hogan and Andre are both larger than life characters, which you just can't create.
What do you think, Kelly, the hype coming into this?
Oh yeah, it was the biggest match in wrestling history, not just WWF history, and to this day is. I don't think anything's touched it in any way, and the way things are going, I don't think you'll ever have anything touch this, because you can't have Andre's undefeated streak again. You can't have a Hogan again and 3 years as champ. I mean, it's just, you're not going to have the same circumstances.
Oh, yeah, there's way too much TV, because one week
Andre
the end. I mean, there's no way. Yeah.
I mean, no, there's no way to replicate.
Him being slammed would have been exposed as a common spot in wrestling, in his matches, as opposed to a big monumental one at WrestleMania 3, you know?
And I almost felt like Jeff's heartbreaking on Jeff Learns Wrestling when we talked about this match, and I explained to him that Andre had indeed lost before and had indeed been slammed after talking about the match. But you're right, because watching it at that time, you're not aware of any of that. Scott, how about you? Is the hype is real here? You're ready? This is the biggest match they could have possibly put together and ready to sell out the... Okay.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. I mean, and time helped this, this feud, because... the only great babyface that could have made an Andre heel turn bigger was Bruno. But in Bruno's prime, Andre was not at that level yet. So there wasn't even a guy. Hogan was in the right place at the right time as a babyface, because even in the Bruno era, there wasn't anybody before that had that. I mean, Luthez, I don't know, Buddy Rogers, who knows? So this is the right place, right time. The perfect legendary superstar who's become nefarious against the gravy train and the man. This is perfect. There's nothing. Vince was very lucky that Andre said yes to this, because nothing would have come close. I mean, this
I
is
find
the
it
biggest
fascinating
match.
You mentioned Bruno, because like with Hulk, you can actually justify in my mind, I can buy Andre is this angry giant with Hulk trying to steal his spotlight and the trophy. But Bruno's such a genuine babyface that I don't think the turn would have worked, because here you can at least, from watching it, buy into the turn, because Hogan can kind of be an egomaniac, which Bruno never came across like that.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny is, I almost think, and we could, this does kind of repeat itself the following year when we begin that storyline, which we won't delve into because we'll obviously get there eventually. Part of you actually sees the sympathy. What was the point of having a trophy smaller than the other? Like, I understand, like, you're almost feeling bad for Andre.
Yeah.
So did the trophy thing even, if the trophies were the same size and Andre was a dick, well, then you can, all right, now you can kind of see it. But once again, the creative or the bookers almost blew this, because you're like, well, Andre's accomplishment's kind of more impressive. Why does he get this little shit trophy and Hogan gets this really nice one?
All that was forgotten. Once Heenan got in the picture, all that was forgotten.
Yeah,
exactly. They got lucky on that. They definitely it definitely worked out for him in that aspect.
Like I said, Hogan did come off like a dick when he barged in and said, "Oh, Andre, you're the greatest," you know, started running his mouth and ruined Elijah's little celebration. But once Heenan came in, all that's out the window. Man.
Yep, I agree.
All right, so Kelly, why don't you take us through the footage? We watched a little bit of a more extensive playlist this time versus the Savage Steamboat, whereas it wasn't just matches. We watched a lot of different kinds of types of build up to this one. So why don't you walk us through the footage and we can chat about it as we head toward the end of the show here.
Yeah, well, you know, it struck me, when we were putting this together that, in the wrestling magazines at the time, they acknowledged the history that these two guys had beyond the WWF, beyond just the last couple of years of the WWF, right? Mm-hmm. The After Mags would talk about the early 80s when Hogan came into New York and was a heel, and he went against Andre. And that was never referenced on WWF television. They would talk about the AWA stuff. Because they could talk about all the territories. They had no borders. They could do whatever they wanted. So the magazines, and I was collecting the magazines at the time, so I got like a bigger picture here. I got this long friendship, started out as a rivalry, right, in the early 80s. They became friends in the AWA, and it spilled over to the WWF years. And so he had this longer story. So I thought, okay, let's expand upon just the immediate build, because there wasn't too much to really go into from like 85, 86, 87 that we haven't already covered. There was the Saturday Night's main event tag with Hogan and Andre against Bundy and Studd. They tagged a few other times on house shows. But yeah, so, and obviously they, you know, they didn't have any immediate singles matches like Savage and Steamboat did. So we go all the way back into the archives. March 21st, 1981, Philadelphia Spectrum. Of course, Titans fans of Titans of Wrestling will be familiar with this match. Pete and I covered it. We covered quite a few Hogan and Andre matches from 1980 and 81. And most of them stunk. You know, the showdown at Shea, a lot of people have seen, I'm sure. Nothing special. The other matches they had around that time, just a lot of bear hugs.
I was saying, and this one, it was weird watching Hogan put the bear hug on Andre. Like, it felt very counterintuitive to see, you know what I mean?
Right.
Dude, that's actually a token spot of Andre matches where he for some reason, would be get bear hugged quite often.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he always was in a bear hug.
Put a bear hug on him in Houston.
Yeah. So Hogan and Andre first met up in the late 70s, actually, in Alabama, I believe it was, the old Gulf Coast territory, when Hogan was Terry Boulder. And on YouTube, or I'm sure it's still there, there's the arm wrestling challenge. I'm sure you guys have probably seen this, between Hogan and Andre from Alabama, where they have an arm wrestling match in the ring. It's about a 5-minute video, but that's from like 78. So a long history with these guys. This match in Philly, this was the same card as the Backlund Slaughter cage match. That was awesome. There was, I believe, a transit strike in Philly at this time, and they still almost sold out the Spectrum. This was a really hot crowd, or hot card. And yeah, this one, of all the matches between Hogan and Andre from this period, this is the only one you really need to see. Because they did an angle on TV. Actually, it was after the showdown at Shea, where Hogan bloodied Andre. He put something metal in his elbow pad.
Loaded the elbow.
Yeah, gave him the axe bomber. Andre bled on TV. And that was a pretty good angle. So they did that, and then this match, you know, is the blow off to that angle, basically, because you get the revenge spot. Andre gets the weapon,
yeah,
takes off Hogan's elbow pad and puts it on. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have Cal Rudman and Dick Graham on commentary.
Unfortunately,
Well, Dick some Graham. Would say unfortunately. Yeah, Dick Graham for sure was nothing special.
It's a legalized murder.
It's legalized murder. It's legalized murder. That's what Cal says after Hogan with Andre hits Hogan with the elbow pad, loaded elbow pad. And another key to this match is there is a bear hug spot, but it's kept short for a change.
Yeah, it's quick.
It's quick. And so this one's mostly a brawl. I love Dick Worley sitting on top of the top turnbuckle and just letting Godzilla and King Kong go at it. That was cool. Blood, of course, in this one. And Hogan loses clean.
Yeah.
And this, I believe, was his last clean loss until WrestleMania 6. So crazy. Almost a decade. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I believe it was. Maybe in Japan, but in the States, I believe this was, or in North America, it was the last one. I really like this match a lot. Rabid Philly crowd. And yeah, great to see them at this early stage have an actual match that's worth watching. Because, yeah.
Yeah, that was real good. I had never seen that before. Thanks for sending that. That was great.
Yeah. It's on a Philly show, so it's not wildly circulated. This was the original tape off of TV, basically. So this one was it's a lot of fun. The first meeting, or the first chapter, I guess we'll say, in this little story here.
What do you think of this one, Scott?
It was a good brawl. Philly crowd was hot. Dick Graham was tolerable. Cal Rudman was dreadful. He was about as bad as the guy. Kel and Pete would appreciate this. In the beginning of those early world classes in 82, that
oh, don't compare him to Gene Goodson. No,
Gene
no.
Goodson Cal's,
Cal's a million times better than
him. Oh, they're both awful.
Cal has a certain je ne sais quoi about him.
Yes. Yeah. If Gene you listen Goodson to enough Cal matches, you'll learn to love him.
Gene Goodson was selling Ford Pintos outside the Sportatorium before he was walking in for those fucking shows. But no, the match itself is really good. It's a good template of kind of how Hogan would be in a heel setting, and it was just perfect. You know, it was vintage babyface Andre when he was mobile. Yeah. So you know, newer fans who may not have seen this, I would highly recommend this match just for Andre. You know, at a time when you never would have expected him to be as limber as he was here.
I think you could hear both Kelly and Pete's heartbreak when Scott said that about Cal Rudman.
Actually, I've never been a big Cal Rudman. Yeah. The outlier of everybody. Yeah. So,
Pete didn't like Dominic DiNucci, didn't like Baron Cicluna.
Why are you
like
even
Cal
on the show, Pete? I don't know.
to be the voice of reason?
Because he likes Boogaloo Shaft, that's why.
Yeah,
who doesn't love Boogaloo Shaft?
Yeah. Oh,
Pete, would you quickly think of Hogan Andre here, 81?
I thought it was okay. Nothing, yeah. You know. I don't ever need to see it again, and then I watched it again after I saw it on Titans. Yeah, it was okay. my favorite part was the payback spot with Andre and the loaded elbow pad. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Kelly, so what's next on the playlist here?
Okay, so now we're going to the AWA where they first teamed up. Hogan came in as a heel to the AWA later in 1981, but was quickly turned babyface because the crowd just immediately embraced him. And Vern saw the writing on the wall and made the right call. So Andre would go to all the territories at this time, and the AWA was one of his favorite stops, or where he would stop quite often. And him and Hogan teamed up quite a bit. So here we are, it's November 7th, 1982, St. Paul Civic Center, and we have a major match here. Hogan and Andre against the whole Heenan family. That's Bobby Heenan himself, Nick Bockwinkle, the AWA world champion, and then Pete alluded to these guys earlier, the Black and Blue Express, great name. Ken Patera and Bobby Duncum. And yeah, so 4-on-2 here. We get an interview with Mean Gene at the beginning. Of course, Mean Gene was in the AWA. And the segment was actually introduced by Eric Bischoff. So this was, I think, from... didn't the AWA do a bunch of like classic shows?
Yeah. I think right toward the end they pumped out a bunch of tapes or classic shows or whatever.
Yeah, there was tapes, and then, yeah, there was, like, the best of AWA.
A bunch of those aired on, I think one or two of those aired on 24/7, but remember they also released those ones that they did later, like in the 90s, where Gene hosted them? Like, it must have been 2000s. I think it was after WCW. Gene was in, like, a studio, and they'd look back.
Yeah, Gene and Greg, and I think Greg. Bockwinkle.
Yeah.
And then also ESPN2. Because I have a lot of them. I have, like, 18 tapes worth. ESPN2 re-aired a lot of them. In like the 2000s. Mm. And I think in like 87, 88, 89, those ESPN shows, I think they did like throwback episode kind of things too. So I think that's where most of that came from when Bischoff was with his frosty hair was hosting those.
Yeah. They always, when they were dying as a territory, would always play up. Oh, Hogan used to be here. Desperation moves.
You never know. Yeah. Maybe someone else will come and he'll be just as good as Hogan.
Well, I remember they put out a tape like the greatest AWA stars of the 80s, and Hogan's picture on the front was, of course, the biggest of them all to sell tapes. Mm.
But in the meantime, watch Jake the Milkman Millen.
That's right. Jake the and rock and roll Buck Zumhoff.
For this match, Leo Nomolini is the referee, and. He was a
football.
It's related to Bob Dabalina.
Yeah,
big football star.
Played for the Niners.
Yeah, with the Niners, but he also was a big wrestling star in San Francisco.
Mr. Lee Dabalini.
he and into the AWA. He had a big series with Lou Fez in the 50s where they did the first match ended in a big controversy where some people recognized Leo as the champion and some recognized Fez. And then they had a big rematch at the Cow Palace that drew like a ridiculously large crowd. He worked in the AWA quite a bit. I'd never seen him. I don't think I've ever seen him wrestle, and I've never seen him otherwise. Interesting guest referee here. Awesome slow count at the end. Unbelievably slow. But the crowd was nuclear hot. Like, if you watch AWA shows from this time, this was at the prime, you know, of the territory. The territory was on fire. They were drawing huge. They had a all-star cast of wrestlers, just top draws up and down the card, all-time legends, Hall of Famers. And yeah, the crowds are always super hot. This was pretty fun, chaotic and all that. And the crowd just blew up like nothing, like crazy at the end. Yeah, I hadn't seen this before, and I was thoroughly entertained by it.
What do you guys think, John?
Oh yeah, I loved it. It was good to see them teaming up like that.
Yeah, it was wild too. The 4-on-2. I mean, it was definitely a wild match. There was a lot going on, and I kept getting losing track because of the quality of the footage. And then Patera and Bobby kind of have like similar stuff on, and it was very confusing at times who the fuck was in there. But it was really entertaining. It was really fun. What'd you think, Scott?
Oh, I liked it a lot. Anything with Nick Bockwinkel is A-okay in my list. But yeah, no, it was good. Just AWA just had just even in their heyday, their you know, production quality was the Drizzlers. because Vern never paid for any of that fucking crap because he was an idiot in that department. But I mean, it was cool to see them team up. But again, anything with Bockwinkel is and Bobby makes it that much better. And it also was a good indicator, Cal, the way you put the playlist together for our listeners of how deep this, you know, feud with Hogan and Bobby goes. I mean, you could argue that it goes back, you know, years before we get to Pontiac, you know?
Oh, yeah. They feuded nonstop in the AWA. That was the feud. Yeah.
Yep.
So next up, or anybody else have any?
Well, my favorite part of the whole thing was we get to see Hogan play setup man to Andre, which we don't see Hogan in the face in peril role very much, where he's setting up the hot tag for someone. So that was fun seeing him in that role reversal.
Yeah, and Hogan doing arm drags too. That was interesting. Totally different Hogan at this point in time. So lastly, we have a match that I've loved since I was a young little kid. This was on one of the first Best of the WWF tapes. A battle royal from St. Louis, from the legendary Kiel Auditorium, in fact. February 10th, 1984. The story here was that the first city that Vince expanded to outside of the Northeast was St. Louis. Actually, the day after Backlund dropped the title to Sheik, December 27th, they did a Wrestling at the Chase taping in St. Louis, and that was kind of the first shot fired by Vince against the NWA. So they were doing a lot of shows in St. Louis at this time, and this battle royal is superstar studded.
Yeah, it was loaded.
Hogan and Andre, of course, but you also have Mil Máscaras here. Jimmy Snuka's in it. Stud, Tiger Chung Lee, Dick Murdoch, Adrian Adonis, Rocky Johnson, Tony Atlas.
And by the way, Rocky Johnson in this match, I mean, he was on fire. He was fucking going crazy in this match. Outside of Hogan and Andre, I thought he shined the most.
Oh, big time. Yeah, this is.
I'm surprised Mil Máscaras actually wanted to job. It was actually agreed to job. Knowing him, I'm surprised he didn't throw Andre over on his own.
Easier said than done.
Yeah. Quite a few highlights in this one. Like, this is one of my all-time favorite battle royals. It may be my all-time favorite. Because you have the big pile-up. Yeah, you have the big pile-up spot, which they used to always do in battle royals back in the day, where someone would get crushed on the bottom, and then they would stretcher him out to get over how dangerous a match the battle royal was. The victim was poor Bob Boyer, who was basically a journeyman guy. I think he had ties to St. Louis, so that's why he was in there, just totally. And then after he's crushed, Orndorff puts the boots to him for adding insult. Yeah. And then they had an undercard, of course, and all these guys wrestled in other matches, and one of the matches was Orndorff against Bob Boyer.
It's got to be pretty early Orndorff, right?
Yeah,
he had just returned. Debuted November 83, I want to say,
right,
so. On TV.
Right out of Mid-South, huh?
He preceded Piper into the territory by a couple months. A lot of these guys were just new to the territory at the time. Mass superstars in this match too, and then Orndorff is just crazy in this match. Takes out Rocky Johnson, slams his head onto the ring post. Rocky's busted open and tossed back into the ring and makes a huge comeback. And eliminates Adonis, and then goes him and Murdoch go out. And actually, one of the undercard matches was Murdoch and Adonis against Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas. And in that match, Johnson was busted open, so he did two blade jobs in one.
Wow!
Great stuff. And then, of course, we have the great finish where Hogan and Andre start fighting each other. Well before WrestleMania 3 years before, which was shocking. And then Big John Studd, of course, takes advantage of this. And it's what a great, great way to book the finish.
Yeah.
Having Hogan and Andre take each other out, essentially. And then Studd comes in, takes advantage of that, and wins. And then, of course, Studd gets his ass kicked after the match. But still, he got the $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
And this was also
you think he used that money for the Body Slam Challenge? Is that where it came from? from this Battle Royal win?
That's what funded the whole thing right there. the last thing we see is a rare interview with Piper. Roddy Piper is Studd's manager. He managed Studd right when
early Piper too. Very early.
Yeah. Piper managed Studd and Schultz and Orndorff. That was his stable. Briefly, Studd didn't last too long in that stable. But yeah, this is I love this. This is super fun stuff, and it plants the seeds of Hogan and Andre years and years in advance.
Any thoughts on the Battle Royal, guys? John?
Nah, I mean, do you guys think that it would help the match any if they used some of the past footage or they were sticking to their nothing shown before, like 1985?
I think it's better the way they did it. I mean,
yeah.
You could have maybe enhanced it a bit, but the way the story had been told, you couldn't really admit that they had fought or touched before, because they're supposed to be best friends that never... I mean, maybe this Battle Royal, you could have said, okay, you know, look, we've always been friends, but when it comes down to competition, you know, we'll do what matters. That's why you shouldn't... Maybe Hogan could have used it, right, and said, look, we've done this before when it mattered, and we were fine after, Andre. Why'd you have to go to this level with Bobby? We could have just had a match and been friends still afterward, like we did in that Battle Royal back in the day.
Yeah,
they just chose to ignore history and go as if there was the first time it was going at it. So.
Well, that's the WWF motto in the 80s.
True.
They ignored enough history.
Yeah. Well, in Vince's thinking, the crowd, it's a different crowd. I mean, the audience, you know, remember, Vince's whole point was to make this more family-friendly, and even in 84, you still had older fans, and kids really weren't watching just yet. So in Vince's eyes, he was able to kind of blind the new generation of fans to that point, because I never knew that. I didn't know until I watched that tape that they ever, like, fought when I watched it. I didn't watch that match till, like, I don't know, 88, because I don't remember seeing that tape. So, you know... The fact that Vince was catering to a whole new audience compared to 1984, you know, he could have got away with it. He didn't have to do it, but it would have been nice. I agree with you, John. It would have helped a little bit. It would have helped some of the logic of the storyline, you know?
What do you think, Pete?
Yeah, it never would have happened. Yeah, it's just not their, I mean, Vince is the king of he'd rather skew the truth and I don't know. I think, of course, it would help because, I mean, any type of history helps stuff. I think for what it needed to be, I think I liked it better that they pretended history never happened, because it's like, you know, it's two mythical objects. This is the first time it meant something. So I think actually having the history might actually hurt the build a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. They didn't need to acknowledge it. the fans were aware of the you know, 85, 86, and that they were buddies, and that was enough, and that they were the two big dogs, right? So
yeah
you don't have to go any further than that.
All right, so the only other footage we watched, we've already pretty much covered, and that was the run of pits from the beginning to the end, pretty much all of them.
Yeah.
So those are all obviously available on YouTube if you want to check them out as we lead in. So I guess we'll wrap things up. And Pete and Kelly, just like I asked you earlier, since you guys are not going to be with us next week to talk three, and this kind of a controversial topic, I guess, at times. Kelly, what's your star rating, and how do you kind of look at Hogan Andre as a match?
Well, it's maybe the most difficult match to rate in wrestling history.
That or the Taker Foley Hell in a Cell, right? I mean, those are the two, like, hardest.
Yeah. How do you do it? Yeah, that one, yeah. I mean, I've watched Hogan and Andre at times in the past and been like, oh, God. This, you know, and I remember showing it once to a group of friends that weren't really wrestling fans, but whenever they were at my place, I would put on some DVDs and they would get into it. But I remember when we watched Hogan Andre, they didn't like it at all. They thought it was, you know, sloppy. There's the spot outside where Andre misses the ring post by a good foot. Yeah. You know, his head doesn't come close. The bear hug goes on for legit, I think, 5 minutes straight at one point. The pile driver that Hogan attempts on the outside also is sloppy. So yeah, without having any, you know, attachment to it, without seeing the Piper's Pits or knowing the angle and watching it, yeah, it's not the most impressive match ever put in the ring, but I mean, it's so iconic. Stars, I mean, the finish is awesome. Perfect finish, of course. Body slam, fall by the leg drop, and, you know, ending two streaks in a matter of moments, ending the body slam streak, well, supposedly, and then ending the undefeated streak right after it. Perfect ending. Great, the crowd, you know, it's got all the intangibles. I'll give it 3.5 stars.
How about you, Pete?
I give it 2.5. I think actually from a storytelling standpoint, it does a good job. I think there's a good psychology. They build to the big spots well. Do they do a ton of stuff in the match? No. But they told a compelling story where you see Hogan working Andre's back, and then Andre's working Hogan's back because the early slam doesn't work. And it actually tells an interesting story. But it's just, I think it's the type of fan you are if you appreciate that type of stuff. And I put a premium on telling the story in the ring, and then what they did well. I've heard some people say this is the greatest match of all time. I think that's absolutely bonkers, but that's not I'm not buying that argument at all. But I enjoyed it for what it is.
Meltzer gave it negative 4 stars.
Oh, he's
in his original.
He really is a moron. No sense of history, that fucking jerk off.
It's 87.
No sense of history, buddy. But he knows history better than probably anybody.
He does. No, Dave's cool. He just 87. Dave is annoying. That's all. So, all right. Anyone have any final
2017 Dave, where he's trolling people on Twitter?
2017 Dave is great because he just knows how to fuck with all these just mouth beaters on Twitter that get all worked up.
That's
all right.
Different. Yeah.
Any final thoughts on either of these matches or anything we've talked about tonight before we wrap up? All right, great.
Pontiac.
That's it. We'll be there. So next week, Mr. D'Amato will be staying. He's just going to hang out here for the week in the studio. He'll be back with us next Monday as we break down all of WrestleMania 3. And then we'll be back the week after that looking at the May Saturday Night's main event. So anything else going on in your world, Scott, coming up?
Well, normally this is a main event week, but obviously with the holiday, we'll take this week off. We'll be back next week, and we're going to debut and talking it over. We're going to kind of spruce up the show a little bit. We're going to debut some new segments and some new pieces that we're working on. So stay tuned next week, post-holiday, for the next episode of Main Event. Myself, the Godfather, Nate Milton, and we got some new stuff to debut. So Looking forward to it.
All right, very good. Should have a new Jeff Learns Wrestling this week. Our Thanksgiving special episode will be just worked out this way due to our ridiculously odd schedule we've been keeping. But Survivor Series 87 will be coming this week as Jeff looks back at that event. Perfect timing for Thanksgiving. So looking forward to chatting that and getting his thoughts. Also check out our Vintage Vault Refresh series. Scott and myself been going through, went through a bunch of pay-per-views. Now we're doing all the Raws and we're to the spring of 95. So it's been an interesting stretch of Raws we're in now. Also each and every Monday, and that's every Thursday. You can also get the ebooks that we produced as well on the right-hand side of PlaceMation.com. Every Monday, my ECW Extreme History column looking back at Hardcore TV's evolution is up at 10 a.m. every Monday, and that is looking through the 1993 ECWs right now. I've done every one so far that's on the network. It's been fun. It's been interesting. So those are quick hit written pieces. They're not reviews, really. Just kind of recaps, and I do different lists and different categories and stuff. So check that out. Shop with us, PlaceMation.com/Amazon, as you reach the holiday season. Of course, we always appreciate that. D'Amato, I don't think you got anything else going on right besides next week.
No, guys. Happy Thanksgiving to all the nation.
Kelly, Pete, right. WorldCast, what do you guys got going on? Besides, well, talk about that, and then what else you got going on besides that?
Yeah, well, Pete, Johnny, and I doing WorldCast, looking at world-class wrestling from 1982, and we're going all the way to 1988 somehow. It's been super fun going through it so far because the cast of characters is pretty wacky. Yeah, there's a lot of funny stuff, but then there's a lot of cool stuff and some legit good to great matches in there too. And yeah, that's all I'm doing right now. Pete?
Yeah, I'm doing WorldCast with Kelly and Johnny. and you might get a kick out of this, Kelly. Coming up, we have a Harley Race King Kong Bundy match, and they reference a big body slam from Harley Race slamming Andre from Houston that talk about.
That's the I think I just watched this episode. It's the the summer Star Wars thing, right? Isn't that the card with Flair and Kerry?
Yeah.
Yep, I just watched that episode. It's actually a very good match, believe it or not.
Yeah, it is a good match. But yeah, they talk about that, which is the match that finally popped up on the old NWA On Demand network. And right. Actually, now the match is in existence of Harley slamming Andre. So that's another one from them.
Yeah.
And then I do World This Week in Wrestling with Timothy. We were on hiatus last week because Timothy was out of town or something. And we'll be back after Thanksgiving. Talking stuff like CWF Mid-Atlantic, NXT, and some whatever show we decided to review, which is going to be a PWX show.
Awesome. And also, I think this has happened since last time we talked, the balloting process for submissions is open for the PTBN Greatest WWE Wrestler Ever project. You can get that information on our Facebook group, the PTBNG WWE Facebook group, or on the Google Doc that has been shared all over the place, ProWrestlingOnly.com, Kayfabe Memories, or just reach out to one of us individually, and we can go ahead and provide that to you. But we do have an online system for you to go in, submit your ballots. We've already gotten a bunch, well over a dozen or so just in the last couple days, as we could start to compile the numbers and results. The deadline to submit your ballot is December 31st at 11:59 p.m., so you have until the end of the year to get those ballots in, and they will be counted. So be sure to submit. And also, when you're submitting the names, just do basic names. Don't do nicknames or quotes. Or poor Stephen Graham almost had a stroke, I think, when he saw the first couple come in. You know, it's like don't you don't have to put rated R superstar Edge. Just put Edge. You know, you don't. Keep it simple. Keep it simple. But we love all the participation so far. It's been an awesome project. The conversation is still going strong in the Facebook group, so be sure to contribute there, as well as our other forums as well. So, with all that said, we'll be back next week. Everyone have a wonderful Thanksgiving. I know we will here, and we'll talk to you next Monday from the Pontiac Silverdome, where we'll be bigger, badder, and better. So everyone take care. Talk to you. You thought you could fool me. Ooh, ooh, Mr. Dabalina, teach me.
wizard put me on a stump and then he schooled me. Prince could be fraudulent, just you wait and see. First he with my money grip, then he stole my honey dip. Mr. Dabalina is a serpent, don't you agree? The little two-timer resembles Aunt Jemima, with jeans and a dirty white hoodie. Seems like he wouldn't be a snake, or would he? Disguises come in all sizes and shapes. Notice the facade of the snakes, they all catch the baits. Even though last year there was GQ, took a lot of time before the DEL could see through the mask. I had to do is ask the emperor and Kwame, and my man responded they were bomb, eh? Fraudulent foe with the strength of Hercules. The way you're on my dick must really hurt your knees. You need to take heed and quit being such a groupie. Ever since I did a little show in Guadalupe, I never saw a groupie like you. But what is funny is you wanted to be down with my crew. But DEL is not down with any clowns of justice. So I would suggest that you try to impress some Professor Dabalina. Because you don't impress me, Dabalina. The style of dress is not the key, Dabalina. It's on the mind and the heart, so you should start by remembering you gotta pay a fee, Dabalina.